situations where too much of a good thing turns out to be too much of a good thing. But that's my input. If anyone else would like to add additional factors into this, please feel free.
WB2EAD.
Yes, Ed.
One of the things you said, Roy, is absolutely perfect. If you're up 100 feet, you're going to have your antenna radiating pattern above a lot more interference, structures, trees, what have you. But there is another one. Ground is a reflector. Now, the antenna, by its concept and design, primary, the peak vertical energy coming off of a docking antenna is right in line with the mass, which presumably is going out towards the horizon, which for HF, with an ionospheric reflection, you want a launch angle. And you get into an interference pattern, which is a fairly broad pattern with a rather wide peak at the horizon. But you are putting some energy down into the ground, which will reflect off, and then you get interference patterns as the phases, you know, add, subtract, cancel, what have you, and have multiple launch angles, which will change with the height. But it depends on a lot of variables, and as you said, Roy, in some cases you might be better off with a lower height, giving you the optimum launch angle for working a particular GX station. But it's kind of a random thing, so you just do the best you can and don't beat yourself up over it. But I will agree, if you are above more ground flutter, the better.
Great. Thank you very much, Ed. I just want to also point out that Earth ground is not a perfect reflector. A percentage of your radiation will be absorbed into Earth ground and warm the worms, and the other part will reflect back out and interact with the field and modify the radiation pattern. But there is a non-zero energy absorption that takes place the closer you are to Earth ground.
Well, the mathematicians consider Earth to be a infinitely flat, perfectly conducting plane, and they refuse to acknowledge anything about this dirt you talk of.
Yeah, I know. We've talked before about theoretical versus real. In a theoretical world, the impedance for an FED half-wave antenna is infinite. It's not. It's 2,000 or 3,000 ohms because we don't live in a theoretical world. And yeah, I know. Theoretical worlds are much cleaner than ours.
Okay, here's a second question. Talking about theoretical. Let's say you have two buildings, 30 stories high, each one of them, and you're able to suspend a Yagi between them by rope. So you have, you know, sort of like a free-floating Yagi up 30 stories. Would that be like the ultimate in antennas? Does that do completely away with ground effects? And, just those two questions.
I have a thought on that one.
Feel free, Ed.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far away, my ham radio work was mostly on 15 meters, the dipole out of my 13th floor apartment windows. Luckily, my bedroom was the middle one, so it was a standard 15-meter dipole that went from just outside my window to just outside my parents' window on one way and just outside my brother's window on the other way. And my view was to the southwest. And it's amazing that 95% of my contacts were to the southwest. And it tells you just how much, just how reflective the steel beams a large apartment building are. In the scenario you gave, you have these random reflectors on the sides. Now, you didn't say which way the Yagi is pointing, but I assume it's pointed such that the two buildings are not, you know, it's not pointing at one of the buildings. But even then, Yagi's put out some energy in all directions. We'll get kinds of reflections and interference patterns, so if anything, I think it would probably make the problem worse. Back to Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Ed. Yeah, I would sort of agree. I think stringing it between two apartment complexes doesn't really add much, and except for problems of mechanics, of the amount of tensile strength that you're going to be required to keep it aloft, especially if any gust blows around. You're still going to have ground coupling. The only way to do away with ground coupling is to situate your antenna in space. Then you're guaranteed not to have any ground coupling. Usually, I mean, the reason why a lot of people go the tower route is because the tower route is relatively efficient and somewhat cost-effective, and, you know, the most mechanically sturdy way of elevating your radiating antennas as high as possible. So I don't think that I count that as the perfect solution myself, personally.
No, it was. I'm not talking practically. Of course, you can't suspend a Yagi between two apartment buildings. I was just talking about the effects of physics on the antenna.
Einstein called these thought experiments.
Yeah, they were very effective. That's how he came out with little bits and pieces of relativity and such. I forget the German word for it. I used to know it, but it's not coming up in my head. But theoretical constructs kind of throw away the real world, leave it to the fundamentals, and might give you a greater insight into things. But then you have to kind of bring it back into the real world again, which is decidedly not theoretical. So even if you do away with the mechanical problems of the situation that you're suggesting, I don't see where it would work any better than a tower at that height.
You have a legal problem.
Well, you know, I mean, some have just outlaws at heart.
Just follow that up. What would be, would a Yagi still be the best type of antenna if you could string it between two buildings 30 stories high, or would something like a rhombic, something like that, actually be better than a beam? Let's say, of course, you can rotate the beam and whatever, just theoretically.
Wait a minute, there's something wrong here. A Yagi and a beam are the same thing.
No, I know. I was talking about, like, the difference between a Yagi and a rhombic.
It depends entirely on the pattern. Yagis and rhombics and all that have a fair amount in common. It depends on, it's all in the details.
I think the problem is that there's no such thing as the perfect antenna. It's sort of like, should your wife be a redhead or a blonde or a brunette? It depends what, if you like redheads better than brunettes. It depends on your purpose. Different antenna designs work differently and serve different purposes. If you are doing something where you don't want to keep moving a directional, that you can just sit back and chat on a net. If you have to keep pointing back and forth, up and down, all over the place, a directional antenna can be a pain in the backside. So it depends what you want out of an antenna at that time. And that's why a lot of people just don't have one or two antennas. Guys who can afford to build antenna farms have a lot of different antennas for a lot of different purposes.
Every antenna is perfect for one application, not so much for any of the others.
Well, it sort of depends. I mean, what would you qualify a 100-watt light bulb? That's been used as an antenna. Well, what's its particular favorite use model?
Not overloading a nearby receiver if you're running a test.
Okay, so you're saying that it's a good dummy load.
Well, in this day and age, you know, I don't think 100-watt antenna is as good a dummy load as people ever thought it was. But, yeah, I mean, sometimes, let's say you're running a test. Let's say you want to measure the distortion of your transmitter, and you have a receiver nearby, and you want to listen to yourself transmit. So you might want to run full power, but not put out a big signal, and you don't want to blow out the front end of your receiver. So you just run it to a dummy load, there's enough leakage, then you monitor your signal quality.
Okay, you know, alright, it sounds okay to me. It's just that it smacks me of a terribly optimistic person will tell me that everyone is great at least one thing. It would be nice if that's the fact. I've met more than 200 people that aren't particularly good at anything that I was able to discern. So I'm not quite. I think it's sort of the same thing with antennas. Some antennas are better than other antennas. They have pluses, they have minuses, they have cost factors, all kinds of interesting things. As long as they radiate energy, they're usable. Whether most people would want to use them depends on a whole bunch of different things. So I'm not quite sure if I would generalize it to the point that every single antenna design ever thought of, history of mankind, is best at some particular thing, because I don't think there's that many different use models to cover all those different designs.
W2BC? I think you'll be able to find, for every antenna, you'll find something that does best. And remember, one spec is cost.
W2BC?
Yes, Rich recognized. Yeah, I think I mentioned that, Ed. You know, one of the things is cost factor. There's very expensive antennas. There's dirt cheap antennas, and usually the dirt cheap antennas are not the classiest ones, but, you know, the price is right. Rich, what do you want to say?
Well, one thing I wanted to say was Echolink went right out on me. All of a sudden it was dead. Didn't hear anything, so I'm on my radio now. Well, you hit to the core of my question, Roy. I was looking for what would be... If you could put an antenna at a vast height, what would be the quote-unquote best antenna? But as you would say, as you said, you can't, you know, I'm talking about HF now, just HF. I mean, if you put a dipole 30 floors up and suspend it between two buildings in the direction that the dipole radiates, would that be a better antenna than a beam radiating at one of those directions? In other words, at that height, without the ground affecting it or whatever, even a long wire, you name the antenna, when you put it in pure space, is there one that would be better than another? Or could a dipole work better in some instances than even a beam, you know, 30 feet up, suspended between two buildings?
I have an answer. May I, Roy?
Certainly. I just want to mention that, Rich, that, yeah, Echolink went down and then went back up again. So if you're interested, if anyone out there is listening, it's probably safe to go back on Echolink. Please feel free, Ed.
Imagine two antennas. The cheapest dipole you can think of, and a truly elaborate 12-element Yagi. If the Yagi is pointed in the right direction, you're better off with the cheap dipole. What you're asking depends on what you want to use it for. There are many things in life, not just antennas. What do you want to use it for? I believe most of us on this channel own cars. Want to call the family for a nice ride? Do you want to carry lumber? Want to race it? They're all very different cars. Taking a family sedan to carry, you know, 2x12x15 feet lumber ain't gonna work. Using your pickup truck on a car racetrack ain't gonna work. It depends on what you want to do.
Okay, let's say what I wanted to do was work DX, and that's all I was interested in. DX from Long Island. Go ahead, Ed.
Yes, where? If you want to use a beam antenna, you have to be able to point it in the proper direction with some non-focus, shall we say, antennas. You take what you get. I've worked DX, I think we've all worked DX off simple antennas. Now, the odds of working DX in a particular direction where a beam antenna goes up with a beam. But it's not mandatory. Remember, they don't give you that much gain. I mean, if you're getting 6 dB out of a beam antenna, that's a lot. That's all one S unit. Will that make a difference in a DX pileup? Absolutely. But if you just blunder across some European station, you might have, you know, 6 dB, 1S unit, might not make that much difference. It's all in the application. There are no general rules.
Say 0 dB.
Come on, man.
You want to say something?
Yeah. Say that I think if you really, if you could string a Yagi between two buildings, you could probably put a vertical on the roof. And I think a vertical or a set of verticals would give you better, you know, omni, you know, you get coverage around, you get vertical polarization. It's also, I think you'd be way better off putting verticals on the roof, stringing a Yagi in between two buildings.
There's a lot to be said for that, but then you get alignment problems and legal problems.
KC2.
Yes, John.
You have to remember that perfect antenna for all scenarios is almost impossible to predict. This is why some people run both vertical and a horizontal, like you said, Roy, that people have different antennas for different purposes. When you're talking DX, once your signal goes up into the ionosphere and it's coming back down somewhere else on the beam, you have no idea what polarity the receiving station is getting. There's people that will be transmitting on horizontal, and at your house on Long Island, you might switch from your horizontal to your vertical, and boom, they're coming in better. If you had an antenna at a 45-degree angle, hey, that might work better too, but no one's going to probably install one like that. A swooper, well, yeah, a swooper might do it. You know, you don't know how it's coming back down, so there is no perfect antenna, like you guys are saying, for every scenario, because you don't know over that DX path where that thing is getting twisted and turned and sent back down. So, yeah, everybody loves to have a big multi-beam, multi-element Yagi up on their tower that they can point anywhere, but you might find out that your vertical sitting on the ground is working better for that particular station. KC2SHO, back to net.
I agree with one minor caveat. You are low-band ham radio-centric in your discussion, and yes, all of the vagaries there will, you know, tend to defeat all of your best ideas. Well, like, if you're talking about, say, a radar antenna, then it's much more, you know, much less variables as far as propagation, polarity, rotation, and things like that.
AF2P with a comment.
Yeah, AF2P.
As an example, today on 40 meters there was a contest for all kinds of stations. On my receiving antenna, which is just a random wire, not tuned to anything, I could hear everybody. On the transmitting antenna, I could not hear them, but they wouldn't be able to hear me. So that's another feature, what you're using the antenna, and what you're using the antenna for, AF2P, Ed.
Wait a minute, you could hear them on a long wire, but what could you not hear them on? We're just talking receive now.
Right, I got an inverted V 40-meter antenna, and all I heard was noise. My noise level on the inverted V antenna was an S9. These stations were lower than that noise level, but on the other antenna, that random wire, the noise was not big, so it was the noise that was hiding it. But the question is the comparison of the two antennas, and one of the variables is noise, and as people are talking about direction and other things.
something is wrong. That does not add up. There is something else.
There's nothing else. I have this random wire antenna untuned that I use as a receive antenna. When I listen on my transmit antenna, which is the inverted V, I hear an awful lot of noise. S9. If nobody's transmitting, I got S9 noise on that antenna. On the random wire, there's almost no noise. It may be local from my house or local houses, but that's the fact is that the two different antennas, and for whatever other factors are happening, one works to receive, the other does not.
Boy, something doesn't sound right to me. Either there's some local noise, or maybe that transmitting antenna has some bad connection. Roy, what do you think?
It's difficult to say, but yeah, it seems kind of strange. You got to kind of figure out that what's going on with the two things. I mean, there are antenna designs that are said to be less noisy, and people have lots of interesting theories of how noise propagation has a different distribution than electromagnetic waves do, but there's probably something in this equation that you and I are missing, because it doesn't sound like the usual case with antennas like that. So I'm sure there's something extra going on.
No, if you were talking about a couple of dB, fine, but the kind of stuff you're talking about does not add up. A long wire antenna, and it's inverted V, but the only difference is that
a lot of things wrong, but it's still, you got two antennas compared, and one outperforms the other for receive, the other, I couldn't transmit on that antenna because it's not tuned. I couldn't, you know, the transmitter would hold down. It doesn't, it wouldn't take the SWR.
It's tuned all right, it's just not for the frequency you want it on.
Well, I mean, it happens to be a random link of a wire that will resonate somewhere, that's true, but there's no tuner involved in it. You know, nothing, no capacitance, no coils, no nothing to tune it. That's the point. It's a random hunk of wire.
Does your transmitting antenna get out okay?
Oh, it's very good. You know, I regularly transmit down to Virginia every night, and I'm 20 over there with RAM. You know, no problem. But there are stations, there's a guy in West Virginia, I can detect his signal there on my transmit antenna if I receive with it. But I can't tell what he's saying. I go to the receive antenna, and if we have a band, then I hear him.
How well do you hear him?
Beautiful. I mean, he might be S5, but I hear him 100%.
Got me there. If I were you, I would check out that inverted. Oh, I'm not sure. If you're getting out okay, you can't be abandoned, you know, can't be this mismatch. Baffled.
Well, you know, how about a beverage antenna? Suppose someone has a properly configured beverage versus a dipole or a Yagi. Come on, that's a low noise antenna. There's nothing wrong, but it works. In many cases, it works much better than the transmitter.
Wait a minute. These two antennas, are they at right angles to each other?
I'm thinking, because the random wire goes in a bunch of directions, so let me about that for a while.
Just take the start and the end and ignore what's in between.
Okay, the wire climbs a tree. Then it goes to another tree and to another tree, and that going, you know, horizontally across the ground, if you look at it, it's up, whatever, 30 feet between the three trees. And it's fed from coax at the base with a single wire going up the tree. So it's got a vertical and two horizontal elements, but they're all one wire. Let me see. Angle of the V faces southwest. No, more, a little bit south of west, let's put it that way.
What is the other antenna? How is it pointing?
Okay, the other antenna, the apex, is in the west corner. Not a typical installation where you'd like 120 degrees between. No. One leg, let's say, mostly south, a little bit west. Other leg goes southeast.
Saying that the antennas are at right angles to each other, if you kind of take the average direction of the random wire?
That's not what I'm saying. Very difficult to describe. But forget that. Forget my antennas. Compare a typical proper beverage to a typical proper dipole or typical proper Yagi. Any configuration you want. A beverage is a low noise antenna. It will receive signals that you won't hear on the other antenna. I don't have that. Mine is not that. But that should be a case you're familiar with.
Yeah, but not to the extent you're talking about. You know, we're talking about a dB here, a dB there for this sort of stuff. You're talking about 6 to 12 dB.
I'm talking about an S9 noise on my 40-meter antenna. In fact, I'll bring the darn thing up now and see what the noise is, because there are times it's lower than that. But most often, it's way up there on the transmitting antenna.
And where's the noise level on the random wire?
Very low, but I'll give you an accurate reading when I do it right now.
While we're waiting, back to Roy, WB280.
Okay, very good. Just for the audience, beverage antennas are, rather than standing wave antennas, traveling. They're called traveling wave antennas. They have a load resistance at the end, and they don't reciprocate back and forth. They're not resonant antennas, but they're very good for stringing close to the ground for low frequency reception. They have low noise characteristics, decent ability to pick up a signal. You would never, in anyone's mind, want to use it as a transmitting antenna, again, because it would be a grossly inefficient one, since most of the energy would be burned through the resistor at the very end of it. And there are antennas that are designed primarily to be receiving only. They tend to be either low noise, like the beverage, or broad banded, like discos and such. So hopefully by then he was able to check his sound. I just want to mention also, unfortunately, EchoLink just keeps on going up and down and up and down and up and down, although it's been live for a whole 28 seconds, so maybe it's finally gotten out of the cycle. Anyway, back to you guys with your background noise levels.
Okay. It now is a bad time to do this because I've got 10 over 9 on my receive antenna on 40 because the foreign stuff is coming in. So I can't get rid of it. But I can try the same thing on 80 and I'll get a difference. Let me go there.
Anyway, back to EchoLink while we wait. It's still going up and down. I could restart it, but it's linked into to All-Star. So with my luck tonight, chances are I'd knock myself off the repeater. So maybe a little bit later when Paul's doing the SpaceNet report and, my amount to say is minimal, I'll try and restore EchoLink if I can. I don't know. It just keeps on rebooting itself every 20, 30 seconds. Anyway, back to the noise level.
Okay, I've got an S2 noise on my TV antenna on 3.927. I've got a little bit over 9 on my transmit antenna.
I just plain give up. I do not understand. That violates everything I know.
Oh, it doesn't, Ed. You're just not thinking of it. If a beverage does that, why wouldn't this do it? Who knows what kind of RF is at the the right, the north end of my house, which is closer to the feed point of the 40, versus the south end of my house, which is closer to the feed point of the random wire. Who knows?
I understand, but it would not explain certain what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Small effect, yes. Huge effect. That is a tremendous. You know, in theory, S2 to S9, 50 RGB difference. That is a humongous amount.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's huge. It doesn't make sense if you think you've got a pure situation. But if you throw in the real world, suppose that I used to get a plasma TV from the next door neighbor would wipe me out. Forget it, I was dead. Now I could go on other bands and be okay, but on certain bands, forget it, I was dead. Now, that's a factor, but it's not an antenna-related factor. This happens to be two different antennas receiving differently and transmitting differently. One I don't transmit on at all, the other I transmit on, and I've got a very nicely 1.3 or 1.2 SLR. Anyway, I think we're beating this thing to death and probably holding up other people. I'm happy to keep talking about it, but I don't want to hog everything. AF2B.
Well, I guess we're going to have to leave this as a mystery, Ed. Maybe there's something pouring out electromagnetic waves in the near field at some point of one of those antennas that isn't being picked up by the other. I sort of agree with you. That's an enormous difference in noise floor. So I can't believe that it's just a design benefit from one and floor in the other. There's got to be something else that's just kind of pouring electromagnetic waves all over the place.
The US2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, just for what it's worth, I went over that frequency that you mentioned, and very, very quiet. I have the 80-meter dipole. Back you are.
Okay, thank you for that. Again, my guess, what do I know, is that there's something just spraying EMI at some point that's being picked up by one antenna and not that much in the other. You know, maybe something in the near field. I don't know, but it just seems like a noise floor differential from hell.
My best guess is something like an arcing, noisy, power pole transformer.
Yeah, welcome to my world, Roy, when you said noise from hell. Yep, yeah, I agree with you.
No, you understand my point, Roy, with an arcing, power distribution transformer? But I don't think it would attenuate that quickly over, such a short distance.
Yeah, it could be something like that, or it could be something a little bit less severe, but really close to the antenna in question. The inverse square law being what it is, you need a lot less noise to have a much greater effect. Maybe that's what's going on. I don't know.
Like you said, Roy, it'll be one of those sweet mysteries of life. Let's move on.
Yes. Yes, indeed. I second the emotion. Okay. Thanks to everyone for that. Rich, any other questions before we move on?
No, that'll cover it, Roy, but you came up with exactly what I was trying to get at. Is there a perfect antenna if it could be suspended 30 stories above the Earth? And I know what the Comcast guys do, the big boys, a lot of times they use a vertical for receiving. When they hear a station, they swing their beam around to that station, and that's how they operate, omnidirectional to directional. So that'll do it, Roy. Thanks. W2BC.
Okay, very good. Let's see. I kind of think we lost everyone on Echolink, although my screen shows the same people logged in, although another screen shows me that it's rebooting every 20 seconds. So let me see. John, N2ZC, are you still out there and do you hear me? Okay, I think that's indicative that the Echolink page just kind of froze on the last group of people who were logged in, including me, and it's busy rebooting away. Let's go to our next person on our list, Ryan, K0BB. What's your question for tonight, Ryan? Perhaps Ryan stepped away. I don't believe he was on Echolink, so we didn't lose him with the rest of the people out there. Give it one more try. Ryan, if you're out there, K0BB, what's your question?
Yeah, K0BB, I was asking for a radio check because I was in a slightly different location.
Oh, okay. Well, you're a bit noisy. You're about 20% noise, but intelligible.
All right, good. Well, I'm moving a little towards Deep Meadow, so maybe I'll get a little better signal. My question is for the eclipse. I see the antenna, so I can listen, you know, because the ionosphere is going to be a little quieter, and I want to see what the signals are going to come in, given the quieter ionosphere. So I want to get a direct antenna that I can basically aim up. I'm trying to figure out what's a good receive antenna that would be directional. I know there's a lot of wideband receive antennas, but I want to know how to make that directional. I'm going to be outside, so I'm in the park, so I'm not going to have tons of space to set up a K0BB.
Well, as we've been talking earlier tonight, the best directional antenna is probably Yagi Uda. I want to say something? Oh, this is great. I seem to have an echo. Let me try recycling.
Well, it is Echolink, isn't it?
Yeah, I heard the echo, and he's going to shut it off and turn it back on, I think. WS2N.
How's that for a terrible pun of the night?
Yeah, very good. I heard you. I heard you. Yeah. Well, we'll see. It was very low here, barely noticeable, but I could hear it. Maybe it's louder at his, you know, what he's receiving. He's here himself. We'll see. Let's stand by. NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Yeah, Rory. So you see the connect times are not progressing on the Echolink side. I'm ready to do a restart. Now, whoever's on All-Star, you're probably going to have to jump in again after the restart. What do you think?
I agree with you. I'm hearing echoes all over the place. So hit the hammer and
All right.
I guess Roy's going to be out for a while. I have to go back home, so I'll be listening, but I won't be able to respond. So if anybody has an answer, I'll keep an eye out for maybe 10 more minutes. Silhouette 0, Bravo, Bravo. Yeah, just to clarify my question real quick, is I just want a space-efficient antenna, somewhat directional, that can be aimed towards the sky.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. Still getting an echo.
ACTGS, NY2H.
Believe you hear me? I'm still hearing an echo. Well, Echolink is working, but I'm still hearing myself.
Let's try it the old-fashioned way.
How how old-fashioned, spawn cap.
Sounds really good, Roy.
Okay, very good. Basically, I'm back to an actual radio instead of a computer and links and all kinds of fun stuff. I don't know why all of a sudden it started to do that. Gosh, I'm really having a run of bad luck with computers and links and all kinds of fun stuff. Anyway, it's unfortunate we couldn't answer Ryan's question. I don't know of any really compact HF type of high gain, you know, focusable antenna. You know, Yagi's kind of are the master design for that, and they don't scale up terribly well. So whereas you could easily manhandle a 2 meter, 70 centimeter Yagi, you know, doing that for the HF in order to check out how the different ionization levels are being affected by a momentary lapse of having a sun baking down on it. I don't know if that's kind of doable under those circumstances. You would probably need a more sophisticated setup.
Question, when is the ellipse?
Next month on the 8th.
April 8th?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
All right, so at least it has a few weeks, because this doesn't sound like a spur-of-the-moment thing. This is something you have to plan for, not longer.
I would think so, unless you have a lot of equipment in a garage someplace that you could easily get to. I am sure that there are more than a few hams out there with similar interests. I don't know whether the slight fluctuations in the ionosphere due to a few minutes of lack of exposure to the sun is going to have that dramatic an effect on propagation conditions. I mean, it'll be interesting to read about. I'm sure someone's going to write it up for QST.
WSQ.
You're still here?
Yeah, we're all still here.
Say, there's two things. One, is that it actually will have an effect. Because even at night, you know, the sun is sending charged particles, right? And I wonder if it's being completely blocked. Anyway, I don't know. We'll find out. There's a whole organization on the side which is dedicated to this idea of doing ham for radio for science, and one of the things they have is radio astronomy during the eclipse. So I'm really hoping to get something together. So I guess we'll see. I hope it'll be something interesting.
I wish you good luck, and I'd love to hear what results you come up with. The problem is not that the lack of the sunlight's not going to have an effect on the ionosphere. It certainly does. But the eclipse is not going to be 5 hours long. So if in the 6 or 7 minutes, and probably 1 minute of total eclipse in some areas, whether that's long enough to be able to really detect it without really sophisticated, expensive, science-grade equipment is kind of dubious to me. But I wish you luck, and I hope you come back and tell us if you discovered anything.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to say, was there
any on this,
the oldest direction? Because I don't necessarily need directional gain as much as I need, like, you know, other directions.
Yeah, I understand, right.
Sounds like the solar wind there. I couldn't hear you.
I just said that I wish you. I hope you'll come back and tell us what you got. And also, Paul is out there trying to get our attention. So, Paul, what do you want to say?
Yeah, in regard to the eclipse, it's like April 8th and 1:30 to 3:30. And there's a group, Citizen Science. It sounds like he knows about it. Ham Radio's Science Investigation. And they have a website, and they're really into it. They're probably going to have hundreds, if not thousands, of people involved. And the idea is to work stations as much as 90 minutes before the eclipse in your area to around 90 minutes after. And this group is going to look for reports, and they'll eventually take all that data, and it might take them forever to figure out what it really means. But that's the idea, is to see if if anything changes. I'm going to do it as well. I'm going to 80 meters. And cause, you know, at nighttime, 80 meters comes alive. I just want to see what happens. And, you know, you send your reports into this group. And the website for that is hamsci.org/eclipse. So it's ham, H-A-M, sci, S-C-I, dot org, O-R-G, /eclipse. You go there, there's a whole bunch of information involved with this. Limark had a great presentation by this fella, Ed WX2R. He comes out of Jersey, but he's the public information officer for this group, HamSci. And it's a presentation that went about an hour on Limark. We have the Limark YouTube channel. You could always look that up. And this guy went on and on. He was just terrific. Anyway, back to you, Roy. WS2I.
Ed is from Shirley, Long Island. He's not.
No, his QTH is New Jersey, is what he said. Is the original QTH? I don't know.
WB2IKT. Definitely from Shirley, Long Island. WX2R. And the public information officer. Definitely not from New Jersey.
Okay. He had the presentation, and he said he comes out of New Jersey. That's what he was saying, anyway. Anyway, he was transmitting from Florida at the time. It's all on Zoom. Anyway, WS2. And Y2H.
Yes, Lou. You did your magic? I'm on radio, so I have no idea if All-Star is echoing still.
Yeah, it might be because you have duplicate connections all the time. You have All-Star and EchoLink, and I don't know if it's going through the same IP over there or what. But anyway, the other guys are on, again, from New Mexico, and the All-Star guys, the two All-Star guys. EchoLink guys, I guess, haven't tried again. But that's not what the reason I'm coming in is on this Eclipse. Yeah, they want you to, if you've used the program Whisper, Joe Taylor's one of the, you know, like the FT8 program, but it has a whisper mode for weak signal propagation, and you can transmit, you can receive and report, and they'd like people to get on whisper probably, I think, an hour before to an hour after the event in your area, and that will help them too. So just wanted to throw that in, NY2H.
AC2GS. So thank you, Lou. By the way, I am, you can see on the different windows that I'm on EchoLink as well as All-Star. The EchoLink, though, is kind of separated reasonably well. It's on a completely different computer, and I'm using a VPN with a different IP address because once upon a time I didn't use a VPN, and the boys at EchoLink were very stern towards me about having more than one EchoLink window coming out of my house using the same IP address. So I should kind of be very separate.
By the way, that noise is coming in from Selden. I don't know if that's somebody on RF doing that, but that's where that's coming from.
Ah, geez. Spring is sprung, and the squirrels are out. Anyway, thank you, Lou. Thank you for all that you do for us. I was considering resetting things, but I noticed that they were tied to All-Star, and at the time, All-Star was working okay for me, so I didn't want to knock myself off of my own neck. So I thank you, and I appreciate your efforts towards towards the repeater, as always.
Hey, C2PL.
Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in. I think Ryan's question was, what field expedient antenna should he be trying to use for that experiment with the Eclipse? I heard that, and then kind of there was a lot of, various interruptions for whatever reason, with the machines and all that. But that was his question. He's going to be doing, I think, a field-deployed station at that time. QSO.
Yeah, I got the sense of that. I mean, that's where I seem to have a problem. You can't get that much directionality, as far as I can think of, in terms of portable antennas that you could travel relatively lightly with, especially if you're going to be investigating HF. You're not going to really be investigating UHF and VHF because it doesn't really act much with the ionosphere. So it's HF in portable mode that has some directionality. That's a good question with so far as I can think, very bad answers. Could you think of a good directional portable HF antenna?
I have a question.
You could actually drag along with you, maybe with some difficulty, and a little bit of engineering beforehand would be a little phased array of verticals.
I have a question.
Yes, Ed.
What frequency range and what three-dimensional coverage volume are you talking about?
That's a very good question. I was assuming it was a more generic HF range, but Ryan, if you're out there and you can answer that, I'd be curious of what frequency range you're planning to investigate. I guess Ryan is out of our range at this point. So it's a good question because it certainly changes, if you want the directional 10-meter antenna, it's much more doable than, God forbid, 160 or 80 meters.
Yeah, but another question is, what coverage volume is he interested in?
If you could be able to.
Yes, Jeff?
Just wondering if you heard my comment before Ed got in there again.
The comment that he was asking about a portable field operational directional antenna, or was there something after that?
I made mention of the possibility of a easily deployed, semi-easily deployed phased array of verticals, QSL.
Yeah, I heard that. I theoretically, yes, but I mean, that is not my idea of something that would be terribly portable. I mean, I would love to kind of see a video of it, but I would hate to actually have to make it, build it, and deploy it.
Phased array verticals, any to steer the beam around the horizon without much effect on the elevation. I get the impression elevation is probably more important than azimuth.
Well, we'll have to ask Ryan next week when he checks in on the technical, because I don't think he's reachable now. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net, complete with interesting little bumps and bounces and all kinds of things. If let me see if EchoLink is back. Let me see if John N2ZC is available. Are you out there, John? No, I guess not. I think what happened is when EchoLink crashed, most people kind of gave up after a couple of tries, and I don't know if they're listening to the the stream. Let me check if they're listening to the stream. Ah, we got loads of people on the stream, so yeah, I guess they're listening on the stream. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We've got 6 people on the stream. So if you're on the stream, EchoLink is operational once again. You might want to try it. We'll give you a couple of seconds. If anyone has any other comments or questions or answers or statements that they feel they would like to get off their chest, please hit that push to talk.
AF2P, Ed with a question.
Yes, Ed.
Talking about an HF antenna and a choke balance for getting rid of the RF on the cable. Everything I've read always indicates you should put it close to the antenna, close to the feed point. What would happen? Let's say you put it at the bottom of the coax. Coax went down to the ground, just for sake of discussion, so that the weight of the choke was supported by the ground. What what's the disadvantage of that? Is it only that that section of coax between that choke and the feed point will radiate, or is there some other tragedy in woods?
AC2GS. Okay. The primary reason, I guess, most people would tell you first is what you mentioned, that anywhere up until the RF choke, it's going to have common mode current, which is radiating and acting as your antenna. So you have radiation where you don't particularly want it to be. If it's close enough in your shack, some of it will sneak into your shack and wreak havoc with your equipment or computers or what have you, or garage doors or what have you. In addition, it changes the mode of the antenna itself, because as far as the laws of physics are concerned, you now have a counterpoise on your antenna, for good or bad. Some antenna designs operate better with a transmission line counterpoise. Sometimes people cut the difference and they put the choke not directly at the antenna feed, but a little distance away from the antenna feed. You get that with things like NFED half waves, where theoretically you're not supposed to need a counterpoise, but generally speaking, if you give it a couple of, a little bit of distance, if you don't just choke it at the very connection to the antenna, it tends to function somewhat better against the laws of physics. So it's two things. It's radiating in places that you don't want it to, and you're changing the characteristics of the antenna by introducing a self-counterpoise to the design.
Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. Please come back again. Anyway, it's been loads of fun. We must do this again. Hopefully one of these times nothing's going to go terribly wrong. My laptop locked up and I had to remember how to unlock it, which is a kind of a farce. You got to hit three buttons in the right order. And then, of course, we had EchoLink lock up, and then we had All-Star Echo. So it's been loads of fun tonight. Anyway, thanks to everyone for participating, and now is a perfectly good time for Paul, WS2N, and the SpaceNet Report.
Oh, okay, very good. Boy, I thought you had another question in there. But, WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. And, we could cover a couple of topics. The main topic, of course, is the Starship that took off last week, last Thursday, on the 14th. Yeah, Elon Musk finally got one of these Starships actually into space, which is a good thing. This is the third attempt, first attempt, that wound up exploding them. Eventually, the second attempt, he got a little further, but that one also had a failure, and they wound up exploding it as well. Probably with the flight termination system, the FTS. Now, the third flight, which took off last Thursday, very successful launch with all 33 Raptor engines. Each Raptor engine is almost 500,000 pounds of thrust, so it's roughly around around 15 million pounds of thrust collectively when it takes off. A little over twice the amount that the Saturn V that used to send our people to the moon 50 years ago produced. So that got off the ground well. It started going in the right direction. I was glad to see. And then next important milestone is to separate the booster from the first stage. The goal was to do that without a problem. Last time after they separated, that's when things failed. But this worked out. The booster separated. They were able to nitrogen thrusters to force it in the opposite direction, and then they reignite the couple of the engines to try to force itself in the direction of Florida again. Meanwhile, it's over in the direction of Texas, rather, to call from Texas. So it's over the Gulf of Mexico, and yeah, it was to have the booster come straight down vertically, you know, tail first, and it started to do that, but then, from what I understand, it lost control, and apparently hit the water 1,000 miles an hour, so they got up until that point. Starship itself, which is the top part, made it to space. The plan was not to go into orbit. They wanted to make sure that on all of these tests that it doesn't go into orbit. The last thing they want is find out they have the